Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 24th of April, these are our main stories. A key witness at the hush money trial of Donald Trump has said he suppressed negative stories about the former president to help him win the 2016 US election. The Israeli military has rejected accusations that its forces buried the bodies of Palestinians at a medical compound in Gaza. And the US Justice Department has agreed a multi-million dollar settlement with more than 100 victims of Larry Nassar, the former USA gymnastics doctor jailed for sex abuse. Also in this podcast,
female patients had significantly lower mortality and readmission rates when they were treated by a female physician as compared to a male physician.
The differences between being treated by female doctors and male ones. Donald Trump was back in court in New York on Tuesday for the second day of his trial. The former president is accused of trying to cover up hush money payments of $130,000 to the porn star Stormy Daniels before he won the 2016 election, a charge he denies. A key witness told the court how he suppressed negative stories about the former president to help him win. The former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, said he paid for exclusive rights to such stories but didn't print them, a scheme known as catch and kill. Before the continuing cross-examination of the witnesses, prosecutors asked the judge to punish Mr. Trump for violating a gagging order with his social media posts on Truth Social. After the day's hearing, Mr. Trump came out of the courtroom and spoke to the media.
I'd love to talk to you people. I'd love to say everything that's on my mind, but I'm restricted because I have a gag order. I think it's a disgrace. It's totally unconstitutional. I don't believe it's never, not to this extent, ever happened before. I'm not allowed to defend myself, and yet other people are allowed to say whatever they want about me. Very, very unfair.
Earlier inside the courtroom, there had been fiery exchanges about the gagging order, as we heard from our correspondent, Neda Taufik.
Prosecutors are essentially saying that he willfully violated the order by posting more than 10 times on social media and his campaign website posts that attacked Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, calling Michael Cohen a serial liar, also just trying to discredit Stormy Daniels. They say that amounted to intimidating potential witnesses. They also took big issue with a post that he had quoted from somebody else, where they said that undercover liberal activists were trying to get on the jury. And prosecutors said ultimately that may have affected jury selection, with one juror wanting to be excused because of the media attention around the case. And so the judge, when he heard from Donald Trump's lawyers to hear their argument, they insisted that Donald Trump wasn't targeting any individuals, that instead he was responding to political attacks that were aimed his way. But when the judge asked for specific evidence to show what original posts he was responding to from Michael Cohen or Stormy Daniels, Todd Blanche, Donald Trump's lawyer, really struggled to provide that evidence. And so the judge, after asking him numerous times, was exasperated. And he said, "You are losing credibility with this court." So it was quite a moment, a real put down of Donald Trump's lawyers. And even though he hasn't decided whether he will hold Donald Trump in court, it certainly looked like Donald Trump's lawyers were losing that argument.
And just finally, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, was back on the witness stand, wasn't he? Why is he important?
he is really there to help the jury understand the backdrop of this case, the kind of catch and kill scheme that prosecutors say was part of a criminal conspiracy to influence the election, but who Donald Trump's lawyers say that kind of catch and kill operation was just how normal newspapers worked, and there was nothing illegal about it. So David Pecker was giving details about that. He gave a bit of history, saying that him and Donald Trump were friends, that they had a mutually beneficial relationship that went back from the 80s up until his campaign, and how there was an agreement among friends, though nothing written down, that he would help his campaign.
Nada Taufik in New York. The U.S. Justice Department has agreed a multi-million dollar settlement with more than 100 victims of Larry Nassar, the former USA gymnastics doctor jailed for sex abuse. The FBI was found to have botched its investigation into Nassar, which began in 2015, leaving him free to continue his assaults for months. He abused more than 300 women and girls in total over 18 years. The Olympic champion Simone Biles was among them. Nomia Iqbal reports from Washington.
This goes all the way back to 2015 and 2016. So Larry Nassar, just to remind people, he worked as a Michigan State University doctor. He also served as a team doctor at USA Gymnastics, which was based in Indianapolis. And he was accused of sexually assaulting hundreds of women and girls. A report found that the FBI first learned about these allegations in 2015, but a report found that they did not take the right investigative steps. And so that meant that Nassar was free for months and months and months to abuse more women. And that included, you mentioned there, the Olympic gold champion Simone Biles, also Ali Raisman, another decorated champion, Michaela Maroney, I should say. And they gave evidence at a Senate hearing in 2021, really distressing, upsetting hearing. And so now here we are, where this settlement has been announced. It's 139 claims made against the FBI. But it's important to note that this is just another settlement. So basically all the settlements total nearly $1 billion. And that's one made by USA Gymnastics and the US Olympic and Paralympic Committee. So this has been going on for some years. Larry Nassar himself has been jailed. He's 60 years old, and it's very unlikely he will ever walk free again.
Nomia Iqbal. Israel has denied allegations by officials in Hamas-run southern Gaza that its forces buried the bodies of Palestinians under a hospital courtyard. The UN's most senior human rights official has expressed horror at the destruction of the Nasser medical complex in Khan Yunis and reports of mass graves at the facility. From Jerusalem, Wira Davis reports.
For several weeks earlier in the war, Israeli forces besieged and then stormed the Nasser hospital complex in Khan Yunis. They withdrew earlier this month. Subsequently, almost 300 bodies were reportedly found buried in the grounds of the hospital, which is in southern Gaza. According to reports, some showed signs of having been summarily killed, and others had apparently been reburied. Volker Türk is the United Nations human rights chief. His spokesperson, Ravina Shamdasani, said that Mr. Türk was horrified by the destruction at Nassar and reports of the graves.
We call for independent, effective, transparent investigations into the deaths. Given the prevailing climate of impunity, this should include international investigators. Hospitals are entitled to very special protection under international humanitarian law. And let's be clear, the intentional killing of civilians, detainees and others who are hors de combat is a war crime.
The Israeli army said reports that it had buried bodies were baseless. The IDF said it examined Palestinian bodies to check they were not hostages and then returned them carefully and respectfully to their place. 200 days into the Gaza war, the Israeli army has carried out some of the heaviest shelling in recent weeks, much of it in northern Gaza. A spokesman said that 25 targets, including military observation posts and missile launch sites, were also struck in the south.
Wira Davis in Jerusalem. As we heard in the earlier podcast, the UK Parliament has voted through the government's Rwanda bill, designed to deter migrants from making the dangerous journey across the English Channel. The legislation will allow some asylum seekers to be sent to the African country. Meanwhile, in the Rwandan capital Kigali, the government says it's ready to start taking in migrants from the UK and to start processing their claims. That's despite concerns outlined by Britain's Supreme Court last year that asylum seekers might not get the protection they are entitled to under international law. And among Rwandans, there are mixed views about the deal. From Kigali, Barbara Plet-Usher reports.
Gardeners are trimming the wall of lushly green hedges at Rwanda's Hope Hostel. It's here the migrants from Britain will land.
This place has been ready for nearly 2 years. It's kind of eerily empty. I'm standing in the internal courtyard, looking up at three floors of rooms, freshly painted, waiting for people to fill them.
Here is a dining area combined with the kitchen.
Ismail Bikina is showing me around. He's the managing director.
You've got all sorts of staff here, even though there's no migrants here.
There are many staff. We are waiting for the asylum seekers, and we have to keep our readiness till they're coming.
Through the windows of the hostel, you can see the rolling hills of Kigali's tidy neighborhoods. It's a beautiful city. The streets are orderly and safe from crime, buzzing with motorcyclists wearing red and yellow helmets. Rwanda works is the country's motto. At this restaurant, though, there are mixed views about the migrant deal. Businessman Emmanuel Kanimba welcomes the idea.
People from different areas always bring different ideas, and I'm sure with the support of the government, I know it will help the country to develop further and also enable those people to develop themselves.
I don't think it's a good idea for Britain to continue and send the asylum seekers to Rwanda.
This man didn't want to identify himself, talking about a view that opposed government policy.
Where are you going to find the jobs for these people? We ourselves, we've graduated, but we've not yet secured jobs. We are out there searching for jobs.
There is a culture of fear here amid widespread allegations that dissent is suppressed. Victoire Ingabire is an opposition figure once jailed on charges of threatening state security. She thinks the asylum seekers are getting a bad deal.
There are people who fled their country because of poverty, because of the war, because of the dictatorship they have in their country. And they will come in a country where they will face the same problems, where they cannot express themselves freely, where they will not have the well-being they are looking in the UK.
Kigali strongly denies this. And its parliament recently passed a law to address the concerns of Britain's Supreme Court to strengthen protections for asylum seekers. I spoke with Doris Uwecheze-Picard, the top official in charge of the agreement.
If the refugees coming here want to hold a protest, can they do it?
Our national laws are very clear about the right to protest. It is protected under specific circumstances. And if they do wish to protest peacefully within the confines of the law, they're welcome to.
I've arrived at a transit camp for refugees who had been stuck in Libya and were having a very hard time there. And so they were brought here as a sort of emergency measure. And this is the project that the Rwandan government talks about when it says it's perfectly capable of looking after refugees and asylum seekers. They get three meals a day served in this dining room. Here I met Daniel Dew, a tall, thin young man from South Sudan. He tells me he's looking for work to support the family he left behind in the village. He tried seven times to cross the sea from Libya to Italy, and he doesn't want to stay in Rwanda.
I want to have a chance to go to another country. I can't able to get a job yet, but I always pray hard to get the chance to get out in Rwanda.
If you had made it to Europe and that European country sent you back, not to Libya but to Rwanda, how would that make you feel?
I cannot do anything because it's not in my hand.
It's all about seeking a better future for those here and those coming. Will Rwanda be a detour for them, a dead end, or a new home?
Barbara Plet-Usher in Rwanda. If you're in hospital, a new study suggests that you're slightly less likely to die or be readmitted if your doctor is a woman. The study, published in the American journal Annals of Internal Medicine, looked at hundreds of thousands of insurance claims between the years 2016 and 2019. Lisa Rottenstein was involved in the study. She is a primary care physician herself and associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco Health Center. Julian Marshall asked her if she was surprised by the findings.
I don't think I was surprised. This is consistent with prior studies showing better outcomes for patients treated by female physicians, both in the outpatient setting, in the inpatient setting. We know that patients treated by female surgeons have better outcomes. But I think what this study adds is the additional nuance, helping us understand that the particular benefit of being treated by a female physician was for female patients who had significantly lower mortality and readmission rates when they were treated by a female physician as compared to a male physician.
But let's just have a look at the statistics. The mortality rate for female patients was 8.15%. when treated by women physicians, in comparison to 8.38% when the doctor was male. On the face of it, that is an almost insignificant difference.
These are large sample sizes, and so it's important to put it into context. And this translates to one additional death per every 420 hospital admissions if those patients were treated by male physicians rather than female physicians. Or you can think about it the other way, one fewer death when those patients were treated by a female physician.
So obviously the question has to be why? Why is there this difference?
A number of studies have really dug into the ways in which female physicians may practice differently and interact with their patients differently. And while this particular study doesn't tell us about those mechanisms, it really sheds a light on what we need to delve further into. And particularly, we need to understand how those differential behaviors may be driving the differences we see. So, for example, studies have shown that female physicians spend more time with their patients. They are more likely to communicate in patient-centered ways and ways that involve their patients in medical decision-making. Female physicians exchange more messages with their patients. And so we know that these behaviors are beneficial and likely underlying some of the differences we saw in this study. I think it's particularly interesting the differences we saw for female patients. The literature has shown us that female patients may be less likely to have their symptoms believed. They may be less likely to have their pain treated. Their symptoms may be exhibited in different ways than male patients exhibit their symptoms. And so what this study suggests is that having a female physician may be particularly beneficial in terms of female patients having their concerns and issues addressed. And this can end up in a difference, actually, in mortality and readmissions for hospitalized patients.
So what does this tell us about the changes that need to be made in medical practices in the United States? Do you need to teach male doctors to behave more like female doctors?
It's a great question. So to some extent, yes, we should be encouraging the behaviors that we find are related to these beneficial outcomes, the patient-centeredness, the time with patients, believing patients' symptoms. There's another piece of it, though, that we should also be thinking about how to incentivize these behaviors, because we can teach all we want. And then if payment is based on the number of patients you have seen, or if there are incentives related to getting patients out of the hospital faster, what we have taught may not be practiced if it is not financially incentivized. So the other piece of the puzzle is paying for care in a way that rewards good outcomes rather than volume, and helping all physicians feel like the careful, thoughtful, patient-centered care we think is delivered by female physicians can be realistically delivered by all physicians.
Lisa Rottenstein, Associate Professor at the University of California. Still to come.
I do think that mentally, I don't think you really do get old. My grandma's 94 and I wouldn't say she's old. She's quite, you know, she's got great vibes.
So at what age do we get old?
Thank you.
I'm Mark Lowen from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at divided opinions over the man leading 1.5 billion Catholics. Some see Pope Francis as too liberal, particularly on LGBTQ issues, while others see him as not progressive enough, especially after a recent document he signed condemning gender theory, reassignment and surrogacy. So how much of a reformer is he, and how woke is the Pope?
A US military plane has landed in the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, the first aircraft to touch down since the international airport closed on the 4th of March due to attacks by criminal gangs. Haitian media say the authorities are expecting other planes to follow. It isn't known who or what the US cargo plane was carrying. On Monday, the United Nations Security Council was told the situation in Haiti is catastrophic and getting worse every day. Catherine Russell of the UN Children's Agency UNICEF told the meeting in New York that the capital, Port-au-Prince, was almost completely cut off by violent gangs.
5.5 million people, including 3 million children, or 2 in every 3 children across the country, need humanitarian assistance. In many areas, essential services have collapsed, while people are losing access to food and safe drinking water. And in some communities, life is more dangerous now than it has ever been.
The BBC received a message from a woman in Port-au-Prince who wants to remain anonymous.
Because of what's happening now, I rarely go outside. The banks in my area stay closed and the streets are almost empty. Schools stay closed too. And as a teacher, I have to teach online, which is hard because not everyone has access to electricity or electronic devices.
Luke Jones heard more from a local journalist, Harold Isaac, who's also in Port-au-Prince.
You have to pretty much think about everything you're doing, your commute, your supplies, you know, your work, if ever you can't attend it. And because there's been a flare-up in gang violence over the weekend, and yesterday, the gang coalition Living Together, led by Barbecue, cut off access again to the main oil terminal of the country, the Varu terminal, and has cut access to the CPS port facilities, which allow for containers to be released into the country with supplies that people really direly need.
And why are the gangs continuing with violence? Because at one point, their main aim, it seems, was to unseat the prime minister. They achieved that. Why are they still wreaking havoc, do you think? What are they saying?
That's the question everybody's asking. Now, what is being discussed is that they are not getting what they are requesting, which is to have either a Supreme Court judge lead the transition or the ex-rebel Guy Philippe. As it stands right now, the presidential council is about, you know, to be installed sometime this week, and that doesn't do it for them.
Harold Isaac, a journalist in Haiti. There's more bad news for the electric car manufacturer Tesla. It's reported a huge fall in profits, down more than 50% in the first 3 months of the year compared with the same period last year. Here's our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore.
It's been a rocky road for Tesla this year. Higher interest rates are taking a bite out of consumers' purchasing power and pushing big purchases out of reach. Competition with China, especially rival electric vehicle maker BYD, is heating up. Sales have been falling, and so has Tesla's stock. It's down more than 40% this year. The company has been cutting prices and announced layoffs. And then on Tuesday, the company reported its first quarter earnings, missing expectations on earnings and revenue. And the company is anticipating lower deliveries this year compared to 2023. But investors have one bright spot to look to. Tesla announced it's speeding up the launch of a lower-priced vehicle. More affordable models could be a boon for cash-strapped U.S. consumers and a hit in big competitive markets worldwide like China and India.
Erin Dillmore. When Karim Bouyakhrishan was arrested in Marbella in January, the Spanish authorities proudly declared that they had caught one of Europe's most wanted, a man who headed up the notorious and violent cocaine cartel Morco Mafia. But now he's on the run after being released on bail, and it's looking like a blunder that could have significant ramifications for the safety of a European princess. The authorities are having to explain how he slipped through their fingers. Our Europe regional editor Nikki Cardwell is following the case.
this man has been part of a cocaine cartel that's been dealing across Europe. A lot of this is to do with ports and chains of supply lines, and he was one of the leaders of it. He's actually a Dutch resident. That is where the interesting part of this story comes in. You may remember earlier in the year, the Dutch royal family said that the heir to the throne, Princess Amalia, had been living in Spain in hiding because of threats to her life. They were from this gang, who've also added kidnap and extortion. Another name that came up that they'd also targeted was Mark Rutte, the Prime Minister. So he was wanted all over Europe, but the Dutch were particularly keen to see him in court over there.
So he was wanted all over Europe, he was arrested, and now he's at large. How did this happen?
He appeared in court. His preliminary hearing was in one of the lower courts. And at that time, as soon as he was arrested, the Dutch applied for extradition, saying they were very serious charges and they wanted to see him over there. This court said, nope, he was charged with very serious offences in Spain and he'd have to be tried there. And somewhere in between more senior people talking, he's appeared in court in March and has been given bail, €50,000 bail, and has been allowed out of court. So he was supposed to appear back in court at the beginning of April, which he did, but 2 weeks later, he did not.
Do they have any idea where he might have gone?
No, we have heard from the Spanish authorities who are saying they think their security services are going to find him, but they don't know where he is. There are reports that he's left the country, but it's a case of watch this space. The Dutch are not impressed.
That was Nikki Cardwell. Four spears taken by the British explorer Captain James Cook when he first landed in Australia have been returned after more than 250 years. They were given back to representatives from the La Perouse Aboriginal community at a ceremony at Trinity College in Cambridge. Our culture reporter Noor Nanji was there.
Representatives of the La Perouse Aboriginal community took part in a procession at Trinity College's Wren Library this morning to witness the handover ceremony. The weapons were taken from a local camp when the British expedition arrived in Australia in 1770 at the site of modern-day Sydney. They were given to Trinity College, Cambridge the following year when Captain Cook returned to England on the Endeavour, and they have been part of the college's collection ever since then. Now they've been formally handed back. Ray Ingrey from the La Perouse community said he welcomed the move.
The spears have a very spiritual importance to our people at Botany Bay, and having them returned after all this time and having them displayed at the very point they were taken in 1770 ensures that we're able to amplify the significance of the spears, but also the events that occurred on that day.
Campaigners have long called for the repatriation of the spears to Australia, where members of the local community still use similar fishing spears. Last year, Trinity College agreed to return them permanently, as Professor Nicholas Thomas explained.
The spears were taken without the consent of the Gwaegul people just over 250 years ago. It's right that they are returned, but it is also positive that they are returned.
Why has it taken so long to return the spears?
Returns processes are complex. In the past, requests were made that were not supported by the Indigenous peoples themselves.
The college is the latest in a long line of institutions to hand back artefacts taken from around the world by British explorers.
Noor Nanji. At what age do we become old? A study by Humboldt University in Berlin has found that pensioners now believe old age starts at nearly 75. That's 4 years older than what pensioners in the 1970s considered old. The researchers say it may be down to longer life expectancy or better health in old age, or a more or less positive view of ageing. Sarah Montague spoke to Baroness Joan Bakewell, an author and playwright, and also Janelle Awomoyi, the BBC's TikTok reporter. Yes, we have one of those. She first asked Joan Bakewell if she considered herself someone who's old.
I'm in my 90s.
And Janelle, you're not?
No.
You're in your 20s?
My 20s, yeah.
OK. Janelle, what do you think of as old? When do you think you will be old? At what age?
Do you know what? I don't think I actually will. I think I can get old physically, but I do think that mentally, I don't think you really do get old. My grandma's 94 and I wouldn't say she's old. She's quite, you know, she's got great vibes. So I think now we're kind of looking a little bit to our inner child when we talk about ourselves.
Joan, when did you become old? I'm assuming you would describe yourself as old now.
I think it's fair to say that once you've hit 90, you're considered old and considered by yourself to be old. Where I notice it most, because although I feel young in heart, is that I'm divorced from pop culture, young culture. I find that very hard to follow now. I don't understand it. I don't really share it. I'm quite bewildered by it, even though I follow it to some extent.
I'm just curious. Did you not think you were old until you hit 90?
I think late middle age goes on till you're 80.
This is wonderful. Okay, I thought I was really rapidly approaching old age. But Janelle, I was quite interested that you think you were equating being old with not being, well, I suppose, having mentally young.
Yes. And I think that that's kind of what younger people kind of think now. They do think, you know, I am young, but younger people are also in their 40s. I wouldn't necessarily say like 40s or being your 50s is old. We're seeing things like shows like Sex in the City that came out years ago, about 10 years ago, 10, 20 years ago. And it was showing a group of women in their 40s dating and kind of living that life that you'd kind of expect to see young women in their 20s. So I think things like that have changed social norms so that now you're kind of just, you just feel like, you know, you're the age you feel.
Joan, I mean, in a way, you said you can't keep up with sort of young culture. I guess some of the stuff that Janelle is talking about there. But so how I'm curious about how we then judge being old. Is it really just down to what, mental attitude?
I think you judge it from where you actually sit in your own life. If I've got grandchildren, you see, who follow the young culture, and I try to catch up with them. I think it depends on your community. I think it depends on your well-being, your concern for yourself, your ability to be part of a community, to be out and active in the world. All these things matter, and they're not a matter of numbers at all.
The author and playwright Joan Bakewell and Janelle Awomoyi, the BBC's TikTok reporter. And that's it from us for now. There will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard. And until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, 5 mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
5 women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.